Thank you. Okay, so now you can hear me. So indeed, I was asked to give an overview of the method. However, of the methodology, it wasn't my initial understanding. And when I came here, I followed all these beautiful introductory talks that we have in the morning, and I realized that my presentation doesn't quite fit. However, looking at it, I realized that if I just give it backwards, it's going to work. So let me start from the most important talk slide, which is the acknowledgement. So actually, all this work I really owe to my two close collaborators, Francisco Asturias and Christian Spahn, who feed me with their problems. Not only the problems, but actually they provide me with solutions. They just tell me how these things are done in their labs. I'm trying to mimic it this way or another in the code. So in what you will hear, one of the points, it was done together in collaboration with Christian. Two big points are actually work equally shared with Francisco Asturias, who hopefully is here in the audience. So to moving back, the conclusions of what you just heard are that the validation should be an integral part of the structure determination process. This is something that I realized a few years ago, and I'm pushing this point very hard. It strikes me as odd that somebody would spend month and month of effort on structure determination, then do a validation test and realize that it was wrong all along. If we have good ideas how to validate individual steps or major advancement in the process, they should be part of this validation, of the structure determination process, not hang or done a posteriori. Another point which I realize, of course, if something is validated, the method should be allowed to fail, meaning something is wrong with the data. We hear many, many talks, people presenting new methods, and all these methods are successful. It always impressed me because many programs that I write fail quite often. Then I realized that, in fact, it's good. It means that something is wrong with the data, and this thing you can also pay attention to during the presentation. Finally, another major point is that our data, windowed particles, are of very poor quality, and it's not just signal-to-noise ratio that is low, but also various problems. Some particles are fragmented, some were windowed past all the tests and simply are not particles. Yes, therefore, it's very difficult to assign some kind of quality scores to individual images. And in what you will see in a moment, you will realize that I always treat particles as members of some kind of a group, and then I worry about performance of this group, and that, in my view, is the correct way to go. So I have to stress the fact that what I'm going to tell in this presentation are purely computational validation methods. I will not talk about any hardware-based or hard methods. While there are indeed excellent things to do, unfortunately, it remains the fact that it's very difficult to collect till data, especially of high quality. And actually, I wanted to validate this point, and I was working just a moment ago on a tilt perversion of this slide, but lacking experience, I failed, and that's what we will have in this presentation, just zero-degree data, and that's how I will approach the problem. So I will end my presentation with showing you an example how this is done in statistics. And actually, I was surprised to realize that cross-validation is a well-known problem in statistics, and they actually talk about preventing overfitting. So while this is purely taken from a statistician, the next couple of slides, you can easily draw parallels. While nothing of what is shown here can be taken as such, modifications are required, but you'll be really surprised how close they are to what we want to accomplish in our work. So the idea is of model selection. By model, in this case, we don't mean a 3D model, but it can be our map conceptually. But in this case, what they worry about what kind of curve can be fit to this point? Yes? So the question which we all know, or anybody who ever attempted to fit the data, is which of these models' curves fits the data the best. It is also well known, but by increasing the order of this curve, in other words, the number of turns it can make, we can do the fit better and better. So if our measure of quality of this model is the least square error, yes, how much these points deviate from this curve, then this, of course, has zero deviation. That's our best model. Obviously, this model is overfitted. So what do we want to do? So what statisticians do, they say, okay, we don't really want to do the best model because then we will end up with overfitted data, but we want a model that has the best predictive power. In other words, we normally have a set of data, say projection images in EM, and we imagine that we have many more. So what would happen if I have some additional data and after fitting, use this curve to predict these values of the data that were not part of the fit itself, all right? So the procedure that is, so formally speaking, the model is this function which we want to fit, there is some noise, and can we establish what is this model that fits the data the best in terms of prediction, predictive power? So in this linear regression, what we do now, or what statisticians do, they randomly choose 30% of the data, and this is a test set. It's left out. The remaining is the training set. So you can see it here. These points are left out. These points are used to fit the straight line. Yes? And now we estimate errors for the points which we didn't use. Yes? And in this particular case, this error is 2.4. All right? So then we extend the resolution. We make it more fancy. And we use a parabola. In this case, this is 0.9. So the error is much lower, as one would reasonably expect. However, in this case, this simple test yields the error of 2.2. So if you remember the values, clearly the parabola is the best, meaning we use this very simple strategy to select the best model, which has best predictive power, which is what we want. The question is, can we do better than that? This is, when I looked at it, I realized it's rather simple. And the problem that I see is that I left out 30% of the data. And what, since it's a random step, these were just at the end, yes, on a tail. Then there would be tremendous bias. So as we know, in cases like that, we use statistical resampling to obtain robust estimates. In other words, I can try to iterate this procedure and randomly leave different subsets of 30% of the data. So the computational cost increases, but this is a small example, so I can do it. And for each trial, I can write down what the error is and then take the overall error as the average. Obviously, this simple modification would yield much more robust estimates. So now I have to move back somewhere to the middle of my presentation and try to relate all that to EM data and estimation of errors of the parameters, in other words, orientation parameters. That's what we care about. So as we all agree, normally the problem that we face is that there is one data set, and reasonably, we are reluctant to leave anything out. Yes? Therefore, resampling strategies are a very good way to assess errors or errors of parameters and so forth. Yes? So this is all based on the assumption or realization, and it's not unreasonable, which is that our data set that we collected actually represents all possible data sets that we could ever collect. In other words, it's typical. Yes? And then when we use this resampling, we pull various aspects of these data sets, and that mimics the situation that we collected actually many, many independent sessions on the microscope and have independent data set. So again, statistical resampling is a way to cheat, to get aspects of all possible data sets from a single data set. So there was some discussion about CTF estimation. Somebody asked the question. And actually, I personally was always bothered by the problem that CPF estimation programs, including my own, report defocus or astigmatism with really impressive accuracy. And normally it runs across the page. If there are 20 digits, there will be 20 digits. Yes? How do we know that it's 20 digits and not one? In other words, what is really the accuracy of these estimates? So then we can look how, again, traditionally, now I think everybody does it. The original idea of this, I think, was Joachim and myself in mid-90s, which is that we chop the micrograph into tiles, and for each of these tiles, we calculate a power spectrum, and then the average of this power spectra is what we use to estimate the power spectrum. Okay, so this is a simple trick to reduce the noise and works very nicely. But if we have these images, yes, this power spectra, it's only natural to calculate not only average, but the variance. And normally, if you do that, you will see something like that. And that's an indication that there is an error. So, yes, either just noise or maybe these rings are moving back and forth. Yes, how to find out whether this is really the case? So I use statistical resampling. And in this case, let's say there are five samples, yes, five examples of this power spectrum taken from different regions. And I will choose randomly a set, yes? So in this case, say I chose 2, 2, 4, 4, 4, okay? That yields some kind of average. I have to remind you that the number of these tiles is normally large, 50, 100, this is just a reduced example. So I choose this sample, this subset or permutation and calculate the average. And then I run a program, a dedicated program, which really works very fast, it's just seconds, which yields defocus and astigmatism parameters. And then obviously I can iterate it over and over and keep writing down what were the parameters, the results of this feed. The rest is really simple because the answer to my problem is the average of all these parameters, but much better, I get the standard deviation, which I interpret as error. So that's what CITER, the program published earlier this year with Christian and Ifan here, does just that. I would encourage you to look at the paper, even though it's only ultramicroscopy, but it contains some interesting thoughts. Particularly, I show the relation between window size, sampling rate, and the defocus that, or in other words, transfer function that can be represented within this window. So if you look at these equations, that would prevent you to using small window images with large defocus. This kind of data creates problems and should be eliminated, but there is a very simple way to find out. And of course, the program not only estimates these parameters, but saves them, and one can sort them and automatically reject bad data. So this is an example of a very simple implementation or simple usage of statistical resampling. However, what we are really interested in are alignment problems, and now I will quickly go through two of them, meaning first one is 2D multi-reference alignment, meaning once we got all these particles, we want to put them into classes. So again, I'm trying to stay away from comparing images using correlation coefficient, either to averages or to each other, as you heard from Nico's introduction, yes? So the observation that we made was, in fact, quite interesting. So I asked my postdoc to prepare me an example of data, just simulated data with very low SNR, when the simple reference-free alignment fails. He worked on a problem for 2 months and got really depressed. It proved to be impossible. Unless this SNR is really small, totally unrealistic, a very simple reference-free alignment, well-known program since ages, will always converge, okay? Therefore, we determined that we established that if the set of images is homogeneous, if they are truly identical, it will always align, no matter what SNR is. So now we assume that the converse is true, yes? If I have a set of images and I keep aligning them one time after another and I always get the same answer, the same average, that means that this data set has to be homogeneous, I cannot prove it, but that's a good assumption, all right? And we call this alignment stable, this group stable, therefore true, okay? So if we can find such subsets of the data set that always align, we solved our problem, okay? So how do we find? Okay, so here is a simple demonstration of it. So I took, these are actual 7PS images from, this is still CCD Polara, yes, high resolution project. And I took a group which alignment determined to be, 3D refinement to be the same, and I took two different classes. So this is one, this is another one. Now I hope you would agree that if I add these two averages, I get something like that, and for somebody like me, not really familiar with the ribosome, it looks quite realistic. Yes, I would take it for a real average. So what can I do with it? Okay, so the idea is that I run this refinement over and over again, and now I do it for this mixed group, and I do it for one of the subset which is pure. Here I don't even know which one is which, but it's not the point. It always gets me these averages, okay? But I know that one of them is fake. So, and I can also calculate Fourier shell correlation. That should give you a pause because, as you see, Fourier shell correlation is not an indication of anything, yes? the resolution curves are the same, yes? So I didn't learn very much. So instead what I do, I look at parameters, alignment parameters of individual images, yes? And I sort them by how far they are from one refinement to another for each image. As you see, for the stable group, which I know that is pure, all images end up in more or less the same position. The wobbling is very little. This we call pixel error, which is like average pixel distance. So this is below, well below one. For this group, which is a mixture 50-50, you see some end up in the same orientation, and then this pixel error goes through the roof because these unstable images that invaded this group end up in different positions. So we have a very simple test now, how to determine whether a group is homogeneous. Now, normally, what you already heard from Nico, we would use k-means clustering. In fact, we do more than k-means clustering because in addition, we have to establish orientations, and that increases number of degrees of freedom. However, the main problems of k-means algorithm remain, and this is that, first, it's a very strongly local algorithm, meaning the outcome depends on the starting point. Second, it is almost guaranteed not to deliver a global solution, meaning the best possible set of classes. It's just something nobody knows what it is. All right? And now if we add to it the problem that we have to align the images, the performance is even worse. I'll skip this. This is just an illustration how it works, which is irrelevant. This I pulled from an actual publication. For some reason, I omitted the authors. But you see the illustration of the problem. Many classes will collapse, yes? So we initialize it with this number of class averages, and then only few look reasonable. And this is this, it's caused by this overdetermination of the problem that we have too many parameters. Many implementations, mainly in 2D, will do some kind of receding. They will put something here, hoping it will pick up. Well, sometimes it will, sometimes it will not. Please keep in mind that all what I said, this criticism of k-means in 2D, also applies to 3D. Unless, and in 3D, the problem is compounded by the number of images and the number of parameters. The take-home message is k-means should be avoided at all costs. If you mistrust my criticism, you can take any program, any package, EM package, that has k-means implementation, make sure or ask the author whether it randomly starts the procedure. Normally, k-means is started by randomly assigning images to various groups and run it twice. I can assure you, you'll be horrified because many averages will not reappear. Some will, but there is no guarantee, as I showed before, that these which reappeared actually even contain the same particles. So having realized that, we set ourselves on fixing the problem. And what we invented, Francisco and I, is what we call equal group size means k-means clustering program, in which instead of setting the number of groups, we set the number of images that we expect per group, with additional requirement that each group has the same number of images. And this is an illustration of the algorithm that I skip. This program, this simple trick, immediately works much better. Yes? In a sense, it delivers very nice gallery of images. However, the convergence properties of this program are even worse than that of k-means. So what we add here is a simple stability test. Yes, the program will produce this gallery that all class averages are subjected to stability test. Unstable images are rejected and procedure is iterated. These in our program, which we call ISAC, and some of you are familiar with it, we call initial or exploratory state, yes, because we don't claim that these are good averages. In fact, these are called candidate class averages, and the program will output them. And here you have an example from a very challenging data set, and this is what you will typically see, so nothing is missing. All these images have the same SSNR because they have the same number of images, so it works very well. Many people who use ISAC nowadays will stop at this point. Yes, the reason is they are so impressed by this result that they don't want to rock the boat and expose themselves to possible failure later, as you see. While I cannot prevent you from doing that, you have to be warned that these class averages are almost as uncertain as those coming from k-means. Yes? The reason is simple. There was no validation. So how do we approach now this huge gallery, and how do we know which class averages are correct or not? So now our validation comes in, and what we do here is a simple reproducibility test. So we mimic a situation which you would have if I took my data set and say, send it to Tom and ask him, well, run the program. Then I send it to Eva and I send it to Francisco, yes? So once we run the program, we start calling each other. We call it a two-way test and exchanging information. So if Eva got some averages which I never seen, then we will delete them, all right? So, and we go back to the program and we run three-way matching. So now we form triplets and again check which averages are reproduced. And finally, we meet somewhere in a nice place. That's La Jolla, yes? And we do the four-way test and we only agree on averages that all of us obtained. And this is finally reproducible set of class averages. Yes? So idea is that some of these class averages survive certain stages, but eventually, as you see, some slowly die, and will not survive four-way test and are eliminated. So what you would see from the output of the program that, so this is an example, as you see, the gallery is much smaller than the previous one, is a subset of validated class averages. These will not necessarily have the same number of images per group, plus not all data set went into these class averages. If you're lucky, that will be about 50%, 60%, but let's not worry about it, because what we really want are very clean class averages. What we are guaranteed that images which are in this group are actually very, very similar to each other. If you run k-means algorithm, you may also get an impressive gallery, but very often, as I said, many class averages will have images which have in it which have nothing to do with each other, meaning the phases are unreliable, and that makes the next step, the ab initio structure determination, difficult, if not impossible. Okay? So we are done. This is ISAC. We got this nice set of class averages. Now we approach the next problem. So now we want to obtain reliable, validated initial 3D structure, which then can be passed to rely on, did I just say that? Or to some other software to refine. So First, we start from realization. Again, we want to work on parameters, not so much on images or common lines, but really on orientation parameters. So first, it's quite an obvious observation that a 3D structure like that comprises the data doesn't change, it is what it is, and orientation parameters which we keep assigning to this data. Now what happens is that having these two, I can get the 3D structure, but it's also true that if I have 3D structure and set of projection parameters, I can obtain orientation parameters doing one step of projection matching. So there is full agreement between set of orientation parameters and the structure. Why would I want to worry about orientation parameter? Actually, only a subset, because I'm only interested in a projection direction, yes, which is this arrow, yes, this tau here. Why would I worry about orientation parameters? The reasons are two. First, it's very easy to do operations such as, you see, these two structures came from different runs of the program, so I would want to know how to put them in the same orientation. So if I just use this projection direction, there is a very simple mathematical trick which will give me the angles in a split second. To align these two volumes would take forever and it's uncertain. So I solved one problem nicely. The second thing is what you already saw in Isaac. Not all projections will end up in the same orientations. Those that didn't signal me that there is something wrong with them or that the procedure is diverging. So now we need, having discussed this, now we need some kind of refinement procedure which can quickly establish guess of a structure. So how to generate the map? This is a good old projection matching, which you all grew to love. And what it does is very simple. We take a structure, we take set of projections, calculate cross-correlation coefficients with a selected image, and we choose the overall maximum over all these correlation coefficients. Now, you heard much about maximum likelihood. In maximum likelihood, you would simply choose more than one. In this context, we would call it soft matching. But let's focus on hard matching. So I choose the best one that yields me orientation parameters, and I can cycle it for all images and compute new guess of the structure. Now, this is a very robust procedure. It has the same problems that K-means algorithm, in the sense that it's a strictly what we call downhill. It will converge very quickly to something which is very similar to your initial structure. Okay, so can we do better? Fortunately for us, Hans Elmlund, about a year and a half ago, came up with a very simple modification of this algorithm, which first makes it paradoxically faster, and second makes it very, very robust. It's, in fact, 2013 here. He called it Prime. So this is Hans with Dominika, his wife. And the modification is as simple as it can get, and I really wish I invented it myself, which is that instead of taking the overall maximum of these measures, we just do it one by one, and we pick up orientation which is better than the one that I inherited from the previous orientation. Most likely, it's totally wrong, but I'm not worried. What it buys me time. Instead of getting trapped immediately, you will see in a second that the structure keeps morphing slowly into a correct solution. And this is, I guess, yeah. So you see? The beginning is very fast. It catches some kind of shape, but this shape is, in fact, incorrect. You see how slowly it goes and gains features. You see these openings appear. Yes? So it's great. Have we solved the problem? Absolutely not. The reason we haven't solved the problem, that again, the convergence properties of these things are not known. And in fact, the procedure, again, this is a simple test case. In this case, twice it got very close. You see, these two solutions not only appear to be correct, but close to each other, but occasionally it will go astray and produce something really, really strange. So what do? We have something that almost works, but not quite. We go into population of solutions, and we borrow ideas from genetic algorithms, meaning instead of doing it once and then wondering whether it's correct or not, we do it many, many times. It's a program of VIPER, validation of individual parameter reproducibility. It's a parameter, how many structures the program will do at the same time to arrive at the correct solution. And then again, we use our trick with our parameters, yes? In a sense, we monitor all these solutions, bring them into registers, and once they are kind of similar to each other, we start exchanging information between them. That may sound complicated, but again, going back to my example, yes, this is again work with Francisco. You see, so in genetic algorithm, we start from totally random things, yes, and I set the number of possible structures to 6, and see, I got this strange gallery. I happen to know that this one is correct or close to it, but very often the program will produce this dual strange shape of variation of it, okay? So now, as in genetic algorithm, I will exchange information between these structures in a random manner, in a sense that I'm taking parameters from different solutions and mixing them up, okay? So now I get set of starting points. They are called offsprings in this language, yes? And as you see, as for offsprings, they look awful, yes? In fact, I lost the best one, yes? But at the same time, these strange guys were really suppressed. And this now serves me as a starting point for the next generation of the algorithm. And sure enough, in this case, I got it right. And then subsequent generations are just refinements of what is already correct. So that works beautifully. But as I said, yes. I take orientation parameters assigned to projections that resulted in this structure and this. In genetic algorithm literatures, there are rules how to do, and they are taken from genetics. There are mutations and things like that. In simple terms, if you imagine that your set of parameters is a list, I can, for example, swap them, yes? So what was assigned to first image will be assigned to second, to the last image. In fact, it's not really very important. What is important is that these structures now should be mixtures of these somehow, as in genetics, yes? These are parents, these are offsprings, and they should share some kind of features of parents. And that gets me away from being trapped, say, in this structure, okay? So it works. But I haven't solved the problem of the fact that ISAG is not guaranteed to produce good class averages. Why? The reason is very simple. It doesn't know that these class averages should have originated from the same structure. So just by chance, it can produce something strange, which is not like other class averages and should not be there. So again, I do the same reproducibility test as I did in ISAC, yes? And we normally do it 3 times. We run VIPER 3 times, and then we looked at a subset of parameters that is about the same. That's a parameter, but it's expressed in pixel, average pixel deviation. I can set it to 1 pixel, for example. Yes, I identify outliers, remove them, and do it again. Yes, so at a certain point, I will arrive at a subset of stable solutions, yes, of subset of class averages that lead to stable solutions, and that's my answer to the problem. I don't have many examples of it, but this is actually a test of a heterogeneous set of ribosome projections, and those of us who are familiar with the molecule will recognize that some of them are just small subunits, this one, this one, this one, and there is 20 of single subunit projections, and it actually happens in nature. They disassociate, and the samples are typically contain some images which shouldn't be there. All right. So now I run these generations, these things, and I keep eliminating. And at least in this case, I convinced myself that it works because in 3 steps I was able to eliminate all these 50S projections. And this is simply done in a semi-automated manner because I also noticed that these errors of assignments kind of increase and then they jump. If something jumps, I cut it here. In fact, I don't show it in the plot. I wish I could show you more examples, but I don't really solve structures that often. I sent this program to a good number of groups, and I never heard from them. That's what I'm saying, I'm leading to. I just hear it worked beautifully. Once we publish it, we'll let you know. And that's where the story ends. But trust me, there are many, many examples. Tom has a very large number of examples. He's still working on publishing them. That's why I cannot show them, the same with Francisco. So I consider it kind of a challenge, and I would be curious what Bridget would have to say. In a sense, it would be good to have some kind of set of class averages, challenging class averages, and see how these methods perform. This almost never fails. Okay, so, and I don't have any conclusions. Thank you.
What are the axes?
In this one, this is what I call sorted pixel error. So this is projection number, this is pixel error. Sorry, as a physicist, I should know to label axes. Yes, good point.
Can I, from here? Yeah, okay. All right, so you mentioned that you could not show some of the examples you have with the Tom and,
yes,
and Francis. You know, for I just wonder, just ask, you know, using Yulong, for example, you can actually identify multiple 3D model, I mean 3D structures afterwards. So using yours, I understand you cannot show, but have you seen good, I mean, high resolution models arising from this analysis?
You mean like different models from
it's
the same
very high
data
resolution,
set?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not really the way it's put together. So sorry, I think that Mel Ohi showed spliceosome resulting from this method at the Gordon conference. So there are many examples. No, the way it's designed, it's, as you see, it's going to a smallest homogeneous subset. This question was, I heard it a couple of times. What I should do is probably now take these that were rejected and run it again. But I'm still working on it. Yes, I should have added that this is still unpublished because I'm working actually on this final stage and to incorporate things like you mentioned. Jose Maria keeps asking me, what if the division is 50-50, where it would go? I don't know, so we'll work on it.
Hi, my name is Isai. Yeah. In the workflow of ISAC, you have a small box at the below, and it says that low-pass filtering or masking, and it was with the question mark.
You're referring to slide 11, I guess.
I'm sorry, I didn't pay attention.
Sorry, the one, we'll get there.
No, it's somewhere in the beginning, actually.
Here.
There was no slide number. So no, sorry, it was not this, I'm sorry. It was one before. Somewhat in the slides, in the initial slides.
This?
No, in the beginning, I think.
Well,
can you please go a bit more slides before?
Before?
Yeah. No? Yeah. Oh. You came to the end.
Okay, can we go back to it later?
No, there was a slide where it has a workflow, and at the bottom it was written low-pass filtering or masking with the question mark.
Oh, that's actually, yes. Yeah, that's an interesting point, in fact. And but it would be a different presentation, which is goes to the way how refinements are done. Excuse me. And I thought there was, in the past, a little bit of the confusion. Because some people assume that refinement is done using unfiltered data. That does not work. The reason is that if there is no low-pass filtration, that gets trapped almost immediately in some kind of totally false solution. So what is now going on in almost all refinement programs that I know about is that somewhere here there will be estimation of a resolution. This yields what is the limiting resolution at this point, yes, to which frequency the structure is valid. Low-pass filter is applied, yes, possibly masking or some other operations, and only this is used as a reference. This prevents very quick overfitting of the data which you would have otherwise.
So, Paul, I wanted to ask, I think it's following on one, what Hong was saying. So in your application to heterogeneous samples, I want to understand whether what you want is the aim is to get to a selection of images that are self-consistent and that you will call a homogeneous set and define that, or whether you really want to identify all possible stable solutions. So anything that is there that is a biochemical, a physically well-defined entity, we always have a percentage of particles that for whatever reason have been partially denatured or whatever, but otherwise, would you describe the equilibrium of states, or would you just find one that is more self-consistent?
So maybe and under this barrage of questions, I should rethink the strategy, because when I thought about it, it was only to eliminate bad class averages. But it seems that there is more interest in heterogeneity, in which case I would have to rethink this last step and see how it really performs. I haven't tested it, I admit it. So now it's purely to eliminate the images which shouldn't be there. Please remember that this is work on class averages, so the resolution is low. So if you have low-level heterogeneity, something moving, something missing, yes, it's good as it is. The question is more, what if you have two completely different objects, as, for example, could be with the spliceosome, what would happen? Yes, that I don't know. But this only serves as a very good starting structures. I also hear that many people would stop at this point. Yes, these structures are typically very, very good. So if you stain data, you probably don't want to go any further because it can only get worse. Yes, but other than that, the idea was only to eliminate bad data.
Mm-hmm. So I have another question. So if you have a system that is very, very good at generating very homogeneous 2D class averages, I don't know if it has, because I just arrived today, I don't know how much this has been discussed in previous days, but ab initio, the more traditional ab initio methods are methods that rely on geometrical principles where you that involve tilting somehow. And again, they rely on very good 2D classifications, and those, in principle, to me, seem like the ideal first step to identify and start to describe heterogeneity.
As I was saying,
not considering those at all? Is that out of your...
No. It's all here, but that was already done by Michael Rademacher some time ago, so I wouldn't want to step on his turf. Plus, it's good as it is, and I have in mind random conical tilt. If one can only collect tilt data, there is absolutely no reason not to do it. However, as we all know, these models are artifactual to a large extent, and sometimes it's difficult to move forward, not to mention, as I'm saying, the collection of tilt data, which never worked for me. So this is for this other case, that you have gallery of 2D averages, which are clearly different, and wonder how they work together. But if you do random conical tilt, so much the better. But I would not recommend using random conical tilt structures as starting points, because of all sorts of artifacts which are difficult to shake.
Yes.
In the beginning, you had a very nice introduction to cross-validation. And then in the end, when you presented VIPER, I was kind of hoping to see whether you'd put in some cross-validation into your assessment of the 3D models you were coming up with. I mean, obviously, they're very homogeneous, and they're also stable, but can you comment on that?
Yeah, so as you see, my answer at this point to validation is reproducibility, because this is what we want, really. We want to be sure that if we do it again, we'll get about the same thing. Another argument not to use leaving out a subset, that normally these steps, initial structures, are done from a very small number of images. It's 100, yes, so there's always this residual fear. If I leave out 30, maybe it doesn't converge at all, and then what? Yes. Somebody.
I want to take issue with the statement that random conical can be are difficult to use because of the artifacts. If you recall your groundbreaking publication in which three different random conical reconstructions were combined to get us the first, to get us really going with the ribosome. And
I remember this work, but there is only that much credit I can give to myself, so I didn't mention.
Well, I give a lot of credit to you for this, but you should remember that paper.
Yes, so there was another line of thinking, and I think I discussed it with Eva, and she thought along the same line. This work eventually led to what we called low-tilt reconstructions. We developed with Joachim this whole package, which worked on 30-degree tilt images to get the initial structure. And I would gladly return to it. It was a very good idea, but it kind of fell apart after a while.
I just want to mention one twist on the random conical tilt that was developed by Andres Letziner, which is the orthogonal tilt reconstruction. Yep. It does have a completely different set of requirements for usage, which is that the particle has to be randomly oriented, which is obviously not the case for RCT. But in that case, those models under those conditions will have no missing cone by definition. So for description of heterogeneous samples where you can directly compare the reconstruction without having to merge volumes is also an alternative.
But yes,
you have
that's
to
right.
have random.
So, yes, as I already said, if one can collect tilt data, one definitely should do initial structures, even if they are not later used, to convince yourself that the structure makes sense. It makes life much easier.
So
and again, kind of going to what Peter said, it goes to this tilt validation. One can think about RCT or orthogonal tilt as tilt validation than before you start the project. Yes, it makes a lot of sense to go this way.
One short question. That's actually a 20S proteasome, right? And usually when I collect data of a proteasome, I only have more or less two or maybe three views. Does the ab initio model generation work if you have like a limited number of views? Or you need a homogeneous sampling?
First, this is not a proteasome. This is HRS, which looks like proteasome. But I get the point. So the answer to it is, typically, if you use ISAC, you will discover that you have many more closely related views than you would get from other techniques. Okay? So I didn't go into the belly of this program, but that's the main challenge for ab initio problems. Normally, when one gets a gallery, where do I have it? Something like that. You see that these views slowly change. Of course, one could try by eye to choose some that are different. But most ab initio programs will fail on that. All these, which are very similar, will get assigned to the same projection direction. And common lines is notorious for doing that. And then everything dies, okay? So large part of the code deals with this problem, how to prevent this collapsing, which you already saw in K-means, yes, in this example. 3D, this problem is very severe. So my advice would be just try ISAC on your data set and see whether you will see these kind of galleries. If you see, they should have slightly different angles, and this program will pick it up and use it correctly.
So we have one last question.
A question here. So we've been using ISAC quite a bit for the last couple of years, and really the results are fantastic. One of the things that we really like about it is the fact that oftentimes you can clean up, well, if your data isn't very good, then the fact that you don't produce reproducible class averages, most of it is going to get thrown away. And so my question now, we haven't tried VIPR. The question is about VIPR. I'm wondering if your data is very messy, if there's a lot of heterogeneity, if there's, if the sample is falling apart, and you run VIPR on it. In your experience, will there be cases where you won't produce a result which might actually be meaningful in the sense that maybe you should go back and sort of to the biochemistry and stabilize.
You're making excellent points. I forgot to mention is that it also fails as per my requirements that programs should fail. And the way it will fail is that, that at this very last stage, what was which I showed, not this, the reproducibility. It will fail on reproducibility. These independent structures, which you will get, will have nothing to do with each other. And that is a very strong indication that it cannot put it together. Yes, you cannot get a reproducible answer from your data set. So it will fail here, and the program stops, because there is no common subset.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.
We're going to move into something very different.